Welcome back to episode 221. I apologize for the quality of my voice, but not the quality of the podcast, because I'm sure you are going to enjoy that. A special welcome to those folks who are listening in country number 63, Iraq, of all places. Maybe Saddam's son has thought, I'm missing out, I need to join in the fun. And here's a couple of guys you can join in the fun with. Gazza, how are you doing? It's been a while.
It has been a while. I'm good, thank you. We've had a couple of weeks off recording, so I'm looking forward to this. And as I say previously, you know, it's always great when we have a guest on. It's fantastic when we have a returning guest, and I'm not going to say too much about who that returning guest might be, because that will be giving it away. But no, I'm all good, pal. Had a good couple of weeks. Obviously, been Easter break, so back at work for the last couple of days, but prior to that, been a couple of weeks off, so nice and refreshed.
Indeed. A bit of time away. He's been to Croatia and he's been to Bosnia. Bosnia's not on the list, and it's still on the list. Not on the list, Gazza. What are you thinking of? Dave, how are you doing?
It cost me an absolute packet, so I apologise. And I'm not going to... And I'll say nothing more than, let's just say, data roaming charges are excessive.
So. Okay. We'll let it slide this occasion, but you'll have to go back then to sort it out.
I'm good. Thank you, Adam. Gaz, it's good to have you back from Croatia. Was that your eyes you having done that time?
No, it wasn't, you cheeky bastard. So,
looking forward to this guest. I did see on the podcast WhatsApp group that a screenshot of some sort of, I think it was the topics or so. I couldn't really tell, to be honest. It's a lot of complicated words. So, it's definitely going to be an education.
Indeed. So last time we were joined by this guest, my brain hurt more than it has hurt since I did my A-levels. Actually, it didn't really hurt then because I didn't put an awful lot of effort into that. But I can tell you, having this guest on was befuddling. Now, if everybody knows this podcast, they know me. I like to make a proliferation of notes and to have questions at the ready. However, on this occasion, I have a virtually blank page in front of me because I made a load of notes last time and they were no use whatsoever. But Stephen, it's great to have you back. Did you want to say hello? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, hi. I think I was on number 211 where we discussed simulation and whether or not we're living in a simulation. It's one of those topics that once you start pulling at the thread, you realize that it's quite a big thread to pull on. So I'm really delighted to be invited back to pick up where that left off and maybe add some other things to it.
Indeed, yeah. So as Dave alluded to there, you sent me an email with a load of things on there, all of which I had to Google to find out exactly what they were. Other than AI, I managed to fathom that one out myself. But we're going to hand it back over to you because you always lead us down a path by starting off with a number of questions that really get us thinking about things in a different way. So if you want to start off with that, you're more than welcome, sir.
Yeah, the first thing I'd like to ask you is, when did you become aware of the impact that AI was going to have in your life? And the next question I've got is, have you thought about, with what we discussed previously about simulation, and we've ventured into AI there, so the second question is, having now heard what's going on with AI all over the place, has that had you thinking again about whether or not we're in this simulation?
Go on, Gazza, we know you like this topic. Did you want to go first?
When was I... See, the AI question, I could be really naive and say, I don't even know whether AI affects me in any way, shape or form, but I won't say that because obviously it does in ways that we probably don't really fully appreciate yet. I suppose obviously my line of work, you know, it was, we started sort of picking up and you've got your typical... in terms of sort of artificial intelligence and almost writing like scripts and writing answers and writing stuff for students. I work in education, so and we started to notice that exam boards and they were starting to talk about, well, you need a policy for this, you need a policy for AI, you need an AI policy and all of that sort of thing. So I was a bit like, oh, okay. And then the more, as you said, Steve, the more you look into it and the more you, I suppose, not really understand it, but at least appreciate that it's around, the more you think, actually, wow, that it probably hits more of us in our lifestyle and our lives than we actually probably realise, if that makes sense. And we've had, I'm not in the school that I'm at currently, but previously, you know, just talking to a couple of colleagues, and they've had kids just logging onto various things and creating various things. And you know, and I don't even know it's the same thing, but, you know, like you chat GTP stuff and all of that. And it's getting, I suppose, artificial intelligence to do things for you that you either can't do or won't do yourself or don't understand up to yourself. So I suppose that probably like sort of 2 or 3 years ago, really, for me, and obviously then the last time that you were on, I was a bit like, oh, right, okay. And that obviously piqued the interest a little bit. So probably 2 or 3 years ago, if I'm honest.
David?
Yeah, I'm not on mute. That's the same as mute. I was just thinking, actually, because I think there's probably two answers to this. And the reason I was just, if you're watching on the video, I was looking up to the left because that's a load of science fiction books with people like Asimov and E.C. Tubb and Moorcock and all those kind of people. And they all would have written about AI, not all of them, but a lot would have written about AI in the 60s and 70s and probably even the 50s. So I probably read these books when I was younger. So I probably read about them in science fictions, not in novels. And you can't help but think when you read these kind of books, is that something that might happen in the future? So I probably thought about it like that, but never in depth enough to think this could be reality. And then I haven't really read those kind of books. I have recently bought them maybe for a 20-year gap. So I've kind of gone from perhaps reading science fiction, talking about what it might look like, then have a 20-year gap and then arrive at it's here. And similar to Gaz, work is probably a place where it's talked about and we use it in work, but it really is the last 12 months where we've actually been looking and using. And you could probably go back 2 years where we knew it was there and something that we perhaps have to deal with.
Yeah, brilliant.
Definitely. I mean, definitely in the case of Asimov, you know, I know he wrote, you know, some of the what he wrote about in terms of his artificial intelligence. That's basically what his stories were all about, and they are fantastic and very, very intelligent. For myself, what I will say is, you know, we've tried to embrace it a little bit here in the podcast. So if you've clicked on this link, you'll have seen an image. That image was created by AI. If you're listening to this now on the audio, the image that you'll see on Spotify and some of the other platforms like Listen Notes and Apple Podcasts, which display an image, that image is also created by AI in most cases, because it's easy in terms of we're not risking copyright. You know, in the past, we'd use an image that we're taking off Google and we'll corrupt it and play with it a little bit to personalize it, make it a bit more TBR themed. But now we've started, and it's so easy. Just use a simple sentence to say, this is what I want it to look like. And then you tweak it a little bit. And all right, you might look at it and think it's crap. Look, it's me who's typing it in. It's not the AI, it's me. It's the input that's the problem. So yeah, in terms of the podcast, we do use it a little bit. And I'm starting to see it at work now. They're starting to talk about, you know, in terms of the customer contact, what can be done there by AI, which is very, very interesting. And if I were in a customer-facing role, I would probably be looking over my shoulder a little bit. However, I'm not, thankfully. But there's something I've seen. I'm going to ask you a question, actually, Steve, because yep. I'm going to get some consumer advice off you while you're here, because it's certainly in the realms of the areas that I'm sure you have an area of expertise in. So the Rabbit R1, I'm seeing the sales there in the US. So it is this little orange gimmicky thing, which is supposed to be better than your mobile phone. It doesn't have apps. You can literally speak into it, ask it to book an Uber for you, ask it to order you a pizza. I think you know which one I'll be doing first. Order some beer and have it delivered to the house. Is that something I should be looking at? Is this a gimmick?
Alexa meets Tamagotchi. Okay, meet with the cuteness of Pokemon, yeah. thrown together. So it's not. What it is it's one of the things that when you start to look at research into AI, one of the things that is abundantly clear is up until relatively recently, and by relatively recently, I'm going to say in the last 12 months, artificial intelligence was very, very good in very specific tasks. So robots, very spatially aware, but don't ask them to, you know, give you a recipe for something. You know, so then you've got GPT, large language models, really good at conversational mimicry, but don't ask them to do something really basic like use common sense, so, or avoid an obstacle. So what we've had until relatively recently is this idea of really clever compartmentalized artificial intelligence, very specific artificial intelligence that does very specific jobs. What we're seeing come together now is we're starting to see the goal has become now, can we chain and sequence these different types of artificial intelligence together in a way that will mimic something we would probably call common sense? So what we're not, so in AI terms, that you're looking for something, the real sort of holy grail of artificial intelligence is something which is called artificial general intelligence. And that's the idea that you can start off a model with absolutely no learning whatsoever, with just a couple of inputs to say, you can see the world, you can hear the world, and then let it start learning what the world is. And eventually at some point it will stop, following what it's learning, and it will start to lead. So that is artificial general intelligence. It's a holy grail for the artificial intelligence world. Where we're at now, where we're very, 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 we're sort of probably less than 2 years off, I think. And I think that where we're near is something called artificially capable intelligence. And that's not my term. I wished I'd have coined that, right? There's a guy called Mustafa Suleiman who he started DeepMind, the company that sold to Google. And his view is pretty much where I come from, the same place, which is if we can get to this idea of chaining different types of artificial intelligence together where they can actually learn from each other, then you're going to end up with this artificially capable intelligence, but you're not going to end up with artificial general intelligence. So it's what you've got there is you've got a cute application of a couple of types of AI starting to work together. It'll be interesting to see what version 5 of that looks like.
I saw on that very theme, Steve, I saw another one. It was on BBC News today. I forget what it was called, but it was a little cube. Was it Apple's? Was it the guys that used to work at Apple and went off and created this thing? I can't remember what it was called. And the reviews were basically universally, it's bad at pretty much everything it does. And the only thing I could be consistently confident in is asking it the time. It was getting panned. And my thoughts were, okay, well, that's fine. But actually, these guys are, you know, pioneering new stuff. They're trying new stuff. And everything that we have in front of us started off crap. You know, if you know, the first iteration of anything, generally crap and doesn't work, and it gets better and better and better. But now we seem to be in this place where if somebody launches something new, because you've got this kind of anti-AI, I think, agenda, and in people's mind and in the wider public sphere, they attack it in a way that they wouldn't have done. You know, when you think that Apple Mac first came out, nobody went, that's crap. You know, everyone's like, wow, that's amazing. Think of the potential of that. Yeah, we're in this situation now, you release something new for AI and it gets panned, which I don't understand it.
But is that because there's a lack of understanding and a lack of knowledge surrounding it, and B, perhaps there's a fear or there's a concern because of the science fiction stories that we hear in the past, and that, you know, computers and robots are going to take over the world and this, that, and the other. Is it a fear in an innate fear maybe, or is it just a lack of understanding I don't get it. I don't understand it. So I don't want anything to do with it type thing. Is that like a standoff thing that we have? I don't know.
We generally have a fear of technology. I think one of the things that I was in a conversation group recently. And one of the things that somebody raised, which I thought was remarkably interesting observation, was that the reason that there's such a visceral fear of AI is if you look at everything that humankind has done up until the point of AI, everything we have done has been about physicality and the manipulation of things, even if it's at the atomic structure level. So everything we pretty much have done has, all progress we have seen in industry has been about manipulation of the physical entity, whether that's mechanization, whether or not it's the Industrial Revolution or farming, it's all about physical manipulation. AI, for the first time ever, takes us completely into the realms where complete environments only rely on digital manipulation. And that takes us into a very, very different space.
Yeah.
Completely. And that's a space that I think people are fearful of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go on, Ed.
I also think, you know, in terms of where that fear comes from as well, you know, George Orwell's got a lot to bloody answer for, you know. So he wrote this fabulous book, which at the time in 1948 seemed very fanciful and very unlikely. But it was a classic, and people still refer to it now. Now, I'm not suggesting that we followed the blueprint there, but certainly during, that period of time from around about 2020 to 22, when the world went a little bit batshit crazy, all of a sudden we became very reliant on our technology. And what we're using now was almost what was predicted back in 1948, that we wouldn't need to leave our homes. And there was a spell there where we weren't allowed to leave our homes. And actually, you know, it was found that the world functioned, I'm going to say just fine, because financially, I'm going to suggest it's not worked out brilliantly for everyone. But it certainly functioned. You could order your groceries. You could have them delivered to your house. Whatever you want, you can order. And in some cases, I'm going to shake my fist at you, Amazon, because you let me down with a bottle of whiskey I ordered over the weekend, but that's another matter. But in most cases, it will get delivered the next day. And that turnaround, even just like something as simple as Just Eat, you can order it on your phone and it's at your house in 40 minutes' time. It's incredible. And in 48, I don't know how he could have necessarily predicted that, but there is that fear, that Big Brother, and it was written from a point of view that there's an evil overlord that is entirely responsible. And everything that we're seeing afterwards that sort of plays into that is tainted with that view. Whether it's beneficial for us or not, it's tainted with the idea that there is some evil overlord who maybe, I don't know, we're going back down to the episode 211 there where we are creating generic numbers for something. I don't know.
So can I give you a different view?
Of course.
One of the things that if you want to hide in today's modern society, the last thing you should do is stop using your credit card. So I see all this stuff about how we should be cash first and only use cash and whatever. If somebody's looking at large scale amounts of data, who's going to stand out as the anomaly? The person who never uses a credit card anywhere, or the person who's using their credit card going about their daily business?
Yeah.
Very true.
Yeah. Take your point, yeah.
So when you've got AI capable of scanning for that sort of pattern, that sort of, you know, I'm a revolutionary, I'm never going to use my digital payment, actually earmarks you as the revolutionary for that sort of solution to spot very, very easily.
Yeah.
So AI will be targeting them first then?
Well, I'm not saying it would. I'm saying if I were training an AI model to look for revolutionary type people, I'd be training it to look for outliers.
Mm. Yeah, makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Go on, guys. What were you going to say? Sorry, pal.
No, I don't think it's there.
No, I don't think he's there.
Coming back to the reasons why people don't like it, or some people don't like it, and I think probably the biggest a fear or the single biggest issue is that it's going to put people out of jobs. And in the office today, and I hadn't mentioned this, the podcast or the theme, and I only thought about it after we started because I'd forgotten what the theme was until I logged on. But Taylor was just saying that she hates AI. She has some choice words for it, but basically she was doing her job, which was claims administration, and she was looking at a claim form and she was having to contact the customer to clarify some questions. And she was just saying, AI can't do this. And I hate AI because AI, because eventually it will, and then I'll be out of a job and other people will be out of a job. I'm just having a bit of a rant about it. But I think it was a rant from a genuine place, that the fear that things will go and therefore jobs will go. And I think there's a lot of merit in that as a prediction. I mean, I don't know, Steve, whether you've seen studies or predictions of what that could look like and how true that is, that there's mass job loss because of AI.
I'm going to name drop here. I've just recently completed the AI program at Oxford Saïd Business School. So I've been very fortunate to speak with academics that have made it their job to look at the impact of AI and the impact on society. They thought it was a bit kooky because I kept wanting to ask them about AI and simulation theory, but that's by the by. Yeah. There seem to be two schools of thought from what I picked up talking with the academics. One school of thought is, well, it's the market, right? And you can't let any one technology take over the market to the point where it destroys 51% of the consumer base. So, because once you've done that, there's no market left. So the first thing is self-regulation of this will start to happen as corporates realize, well, actually, if we're not employing people, who's buying the product we're selling? And that's where the opposite argument comes in, which is the argument for we've finally reached the point where we don't have to convince people to work in order to have a fulfilling life. What we have to do is offer them some form of income, some form of, you know, universal basic income. And the most interesting point that I came across in one of those discussions was there's a massive ethical issue at the moment. If you look at people like OpenAI, who created ChatGPT, and DALL-E, which is the image generation tool, if you look at them, it's recently been known or become known that they just let their models loose on everything that was out there on the internet as part of their training. Now, that means there is literally a global class action copyright lawsuit available. And if you look at the models like Saudi Arabia, where effectively, you know, there's a rich natural resource there, and a lot of people have become wealthy as a result of that rich natural resource. One of the arguments is, do you actually say we take the some learning of mankind that AI is now going to tap into, and do we just pay everybody for the fact that all of that copyright has been taken? So do we actually use the AI engines as a way of generating revenue to pay to people so they can then pursue other activities?
So rather than make it open, actually make it a commodity, license it, and then use that to pay this general household income for people.
Yeah.
We don't need as many people to work anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, what you're actually saying, and it's a very odd concept, but you're saying your job from now on is to go create whatever you want to create and just not consume too much.
Sounds reasonable. I could do that.
Well, it's interesting. The person you had the discussion with in work today, what would their thought on that be?
Yeah. They'd go for it. Absolutely. If I said you can earn the same money by not coming to work and consuming less, I'm pretty sure they'd go for it.
And actually, what I want you to do is go out there and be as creative as possible. Because if you're not creative as a human, all that's going to happen is AI will start feeding on its own generated stuff and it will start to consume itself.
Yeah. So go do some painting, go write some poetry, share your opinions on stuff. Go do whatever, but you don't have to work. Do it in your own time. Just don't consume a lot.
Yeah, you will receive an income for contributing into the global model.
Yeah, good. Sign me up.
Wait a second. Don't sign you on. It's all over to the devil just yet. Here's my question. Okay, so it's wonderful. And almost, in some ways, we have that already. For those who, for whatever reason, cannot work, or work is not available to them at that point in time, there is a payment scheme for them to make sure that they have the basic rights that they need to exist, and a little bit more, because you need a little bit of luxuries in your life from time to time. You can't just have the basics, otherwise you go absolutely potty. So would it be the case that your colleague, David, would get paid the same, or where's the incentive for them to do more? And this is coming from me, who's probably, bear in mind, as we talked about two episodes ago, the anarcho-pacifist candidate from some years ago. You know, my disdain for politics, my disdain for the system, how I fight against it inwardly rather than outwardly. I'm not that anarchic, as it actually turns out. I'm more of a Rick Mayall type character. But where's the incentive? Where's the incentive for that person to better themselves? In your system, there is a ladder. They can progress and they can earn more product. They can earn more money to buy that product. Where's the incentive in the system where they can just be creative? Can they earn more from being more creative? I don't know. I don't know how that works.
Well, the way I'd see it is my little house would have everything I need in terms of warmth and shelter, and it'd be in a pollution-free environment, perhaps in a field with a bit of space around it. And then I'd take up learning to write, poetry, art, craft, woodwork, hunting, I don't know, whatever. And that's how I would give back to the AI system, by feeding it. And all I would need is enough to keep myself, you know, food, shelter, warmth. And, you know, you said people need a little luxury to be happy. Well, I think that's, I'm not sure that's true. I mean, luxuries is just, as everybody's luxury is different, isn't it? Some people have much simpler needs, and most people think they want stuff they don't. And actually, if you stripped it all back and you gave a lot of people the opportunity to have a very simple life with a bit of an allotment, a bit of a vegetable patch, some chickens, a couple of sheep and the odd pig, I think most people would be a hell of a lot happier if they knew that that was a safe, secure future. They wouldn't need anything else. I could absolutely do that.
I don't know that I can. I don't know that I can. I agree with you. I know exactly what you're saying. I remember Jimmy Carr. I saw a clip of Jimmy Carr saying recently that there's nothing you can buy in a shopping mall that you're going to want or need 5 or 10 years from now. It will bring you no happiness whatsoever. There's nothing to be gained by doing it. So, I thought about that, and I thought, you know what, you're probably true. It's probably correct what you're saying there. That said, I think there is a little bit of me that does need what I would deem luxuries, whether that's a nice beer or a nice bottle of whiskey or something like that. I don't know. And a nice conversation on a podcast like this. So, how does AI tie in then with your simulation theory? And I shudder to ask that question.
So there's a couple of spaces. I don't know if you remember, but one of the things when we were sort of closing off the last conversation, I was asked whether or not I believed, you know, in the simulation. I said one of the things that had stopped me believing in simulation fully, wholeheartedly, was this idea that we're conscious and we have consciousness, whereas AI and nothing we've seen to date can simulate that consciousness, until some researchers in Ireland had actually managed to watch the brain operating in a state that was the equivalent of quantum entanglement, and we know that quantum computing is the way forward. So from that perspective, that's that one bridge that sort of, it took away my last doubt around simulation and simulation theory. What I'm seeing with AI is the start of limited simulation. So as I said, we're nowhere near artificial general intelligence, but within a couple of years, 2-3 years, we will be at this sort of this interim stage where we've got sort of artificial capable intelligence, where it can start to, one artificial intelligence system will be able to interact with another artificial intelligence system, and they'll be able to learn from each other. So we're at that start now, where we as a society could start generating simulations. And in fact, there are ways we're already in very limited models. There are ways we are building simulations. I don't know if you know, but so do you know anything about DeepMind, the company that sort of hit the news when they got bought by Google when they were 4 years old? Do you know any of the background to DeepMind at all? Or should I give you a quick potted history? Because
Give us the history.
David and I know all about it, but for our listeners, shall we share it for them?
So a guy called Mustafa Suleiman and some other people started DeepMind, and in 2014 they got bought by Google. In 2014 they started, I think, and they got bought within 4 years by Google. So they did some really interesting things quite early on. So the first thing they did was they started working on an AI that would learn how to play Go. Now, IBM had mastered chess. They'd already done their, you know, with Deep Blue, they'd mastered the chess and beat Kasparov. Just give you a quick hint at the difference. So chess has got 10 to the power of 40 legal moves. So that's 10 and 40 zeros legal moves, right? Go is an ancient game, about 5,500 years. That's a bit like Othello on steroids. Go has got 10 to the power of 170 legal moves. So it's estimated there are more legal moves in Go than there are atoms in the universe. Okay, so that's the level, the order of complexity more that Go is a game. And actually, people who are grandmasters, or they call them ninja dans at Go, will often tell you they can't learn a strategy, that it's more a gut feeling. It's almost like a Jedi type feeling. In 2016, DeepMind produced a system called AlphaGo, and it beat a ninth Dan ninja black belt at Go. And what was interesting about the game was move number 37. So the AI called AlphaGo played this move in move number 37, and everyone looking at it couldn't understand. Everyone looking at the game couldn't understand why it had played this particular move that it had played. It made no sense whatsoever. And everyone thought it had made a mistake. It had cracked and it had made a mistake. It turned out that actually, as you go further through the game, move 37 was a pivotal, crucial move. And what had happened on that day was this piece of AI had formulated a completely new strategy for winning the game of Go, a strategy that no human had ever created. So for the first time ever, it couldn't, because of the number of moves, it couldn't have analyzed every possible move to decide that was the right move to make. It had to literally make a leap of faith that it was doing the right thing in making that move.
Now, just explain that, Steve. Computer leap of faith.
So
just want to pause on that.
Yes. Yeah, so what happens with most AI models, what happens is the way that chess works is it goes forward. It forward chains X number of moves to see what the, and then it gives each one a score. When you look at the number of potential moves off a Go move, you can't do that thing called forward chaining. So what it had actually done is it had created a strategy to take the human player in a direction. It had already formulated the strategy to take the human player in a particular direction. And that's something that no artificial intelligence tool had ever done before. It had always reacted and then gone for the most optimal move. This actually created a strategy and then took the player in the direction it wanted it to go.
So was that... I hesitate to use the word programmed when we're talking about AI.
Yeah.
But was that taught? Was it learning? Did it have some kind of seed to understand what a strategy was rather than a simple odds-based prediction?
Yeah, so in AI, there are different types of AI that you can sort of you can use, right? And one of the things that the people over at DeepMind have done is they've sort of cornered the idea of deep learning, which is this idea that we can use a series of rewards. So you basically tell the algorithm, here's the outcome, and if you get the outcome, then you will get rewards, and rewards are a point scoring system, and it literally starts playing millions and millions of games, and it figures out optimal strategies. So for the first time ever, having played these millions of games, it realized that some of the strategies it was developing could actually get it to the reward that it wanted. So you've not programmed that. You've just given the algorithm a set of boundaries and told it, these are your reward points. When you get to this stage in a game, that's a reward point. When you get to this stage in a game, that's a reward point. And it then has to figure out which strategy it's going to use to get there. So that was DeepMind. DeepMind have sort of, they got into that using this sort of idea of strategy reward, and then they use something called backchaining to analyze where they'd gone wrong. And you do that literally over tens of millions of games. OpenAI, at the same time, they were developing a similar concept, really. So that what they were doing, there are some brilliant videos out on YouTube. If anyone's listening, if you YouTube OpenAI hide and seek agents, OpenAI hide and seek agents. Now, these were released 4 years ago, right? And what these are these are using this reinforcement learning technique. What they're doing is these agents are, some are hiding and some are looking for them, and they're making up the rules as they go along. So that once they've played a few thousand games, you'll put some things into the world, like here are some barriers. And what will happen is after a few more thousand games, the hiders will realize that if they move the barriers into position, the seekers can't see them. Now, you've never programmed into the AI hide from the seeker using the barrier. The algorithm has actually figured that out. It's actually figured out that it can use the barriers. Equally, the seekers, having lost a few thousand games, start to realize that if they move a barrier, they might be able to see somebody. So at that point, they figured out barriers aren't fixed and we can move them. And they're continually learning. None of that is coded. So that's something called reinforcement learning. And that's a technique in AI that helps AI to get better and better and better, basically by doing millions and millions of simulations and learning the reward points and learning the fail points.
Here's a question I have now. So I don't know about you, I suspect you probably don't. It might be just, well, it won't be just me. I know there's plenty of folks out there, but they personalize inanimate objects. Now, there's plenty of people out there who will give their car a name, refer to their car as a gender, normally a she, I think is normally the way it goes. However, so with this, when we sort of say it, we are almost calling it an entity in some ways. We aren't giving it an agenda. We aren't assigning it a personality, but we are sort of making it an individual. Is there a little bit of us out there that's doing that more, giving it more credit than it's perhaps due? I don't know.
Well, the term for that is anthropomorphication. So that's whenever you give anything that the characteristics of being a human. And we do it with our dogs. You know, we say the dog's being cheeky when really the dog just wants food. Mm-hmm. You know, we're saying the cat loves us when really the cat just wants food. So, you know, we anthropomorphize a lot, but we are starting to do it. And the thing is, for me, the technology is now making it easier for us to anthropomorphize, because the technology is mimicking more and more basic human intelligence. And I do question whether or not we actually want artificial general intelligence. I have enough hassle with getting lip from people. I don't want a whole load of super fast computers figuring out that they can give me lip even better. So I'm not sure we actually want artificial general intelligence. I look at the world and I'm not sure I want to recreate that in a computer brain.
The thing that I'm struggling with is, and I've listened to obviously a lot of what you said, the thing I'm struggling with is it the fact that computers now, and there's a computer that has, you know, the computational power of the entire human species or whatever it may be, mm-hmm. you know, and they can do billions and billions and billions of sort of computations per second. And are they learning, or are they just like going through all of the possible options because they can do that, because they can compute so fast and so quickly that it looks like they're learning? But then I suppose my question is, are they learning, or are they just using their back catalogue of so many different calculations and computations that actually they get to the right point, if that makes sense?
The Go example proves that, because there are so many combinations of moves, you can't do it by brute force number crunching. So what it has actually done is it has devised a series of strategies, and then what it's done is it's trialed the strategies to figure out which are the most effective strategies. So you can't, the Go example, you cannot just hard calculate all those moves and all the moves that will chain off every move you make. It, under current computational technological bandwidth and limitations, you could not calculate all of the potential forward moves. So at that point, it, by our definition of learning, it went, I'm not going to try and do that. I'm going to try limited strategies to see which one gets me the furthest. Now, that was, it was never programmed to try different strategies.
I think the learning is, and I can feel the headache, Gaz, because I think we have to detach learning from human beings, and or not detach it, but think of when we learn something. Imagine when you learn something new and strip that right down to the basics, especially when you're playing golf, Gaz. Imagine the first time you were learning to hit that sand wedge or something. Yeah. You know, imagine you didn't have an instructor or anything. You'd just go, you'd hit a ball, you'd shank it, you'd slice it, you'd turf it, you'd top it, you'd whatever, whatever. And you keep doing it and doing it and doing it. And each time you get a better and better outcome until eventually you get the result that in Steve's analogy, you earn the points because you've hit the ball, it's gone in the hole. And I guess that level of learning just through repetition and trying something different, it's learning, but it's kind of a hard concept in our heads to think of a computer doing that.
Yeah, and I think and I get the fact that do computers learn, or do they just run through all of the possible outcomes that are in their capacity to go through it? Does that make sense, Steve? And that's what you're struggling with.
And they can't. That when you look at the Go problem, it is physically impossible. There is not enough time on the planet for it to have gone, if I make this move, what happens after that? What happens after that? What happens after that? What happens after that?
Even the computational power that we now have in terms of the computers that can, like, more than the capacity of the human brain or whatever it may be.
If you're going to try and brute force that with the biggest supercomputer we've got in the world today, it would take you about 126 years. For one game.
Okay.
So at that point, what it has done is it's learned to try different strategies and see which of the strategies might be the most effective. So it's learning at a meta level.
Yeah.
And not at an individual move level.
Yeah. And by one game, you mean that you have move one and then move two by the opposition, and then move three is your second move. And beyond that point, that's a linear game. So if move two was different, it has no idea what to do next. It would have to have those 126 years again to learn from that point forward, which is why it's impossible. It can never do every single combination.
Yeah, you can't brute force all the game variations. Mm. And so you asked where that brings me from a simulation perspective. So there's another stream going parallel to what's going on in AI, which is synthetic biology. I don't know if you've come across this idea. The idea that, so if you think, one of the other things about the AI stuff is we are starting to use AI to, if you think about DNA is the fundamental building block of life. What that building block happens with those building blocks is they get recombined into proteins, and proteins are actually the thing that pretty much every living organism are made of. So one of the things that AI is now doing is it's being given a sequence of protein strands, and it's being used to fold them into complex structures and actually go, actually, if you take these two, three, four different proteins and fold them together in this way, there you've got a potential vaccine. There you've got a new type of corn. There you've got a new frog newt hybrid. So what we're doing with AI in that format is we're actually using it to solve problems. There was a protein folding competition that ran for 16 years until the people from DeepMind got involved. And that basically scientists were given random strands of DNA and combinations of proteins and told, right, go and figure out using these bits of puzzle what this could be, what you think this could end up being. And they were given 45 of them, I think, in total. And the biggest score that anyone had ever got to was, without knowing what it was, by basically just being given the building blocks, I think the biggest score was something like 12 out of 45. What happened was DeepMind got involved. The second attempt at doing it, they got two-thirds of them right using the AI model. So again, what this thing was doing, it was learning in a way that humans couldn't learn, and it was doing the job faster. Mm. So what we're now seeing is we're starting to see synthetic biology take off. So synthetic biology is where you start to edit DNA and you start to put it together to make things that didn't exist previously. So if you want a glow-in-the-dark Labrador, you take some Labrador embryos and you edit the DNA to put some jellyfish DNA into them so that your dog glows in the dark when it's out at night, right? So and it's something called CRISPR, right? Which is you go Google CRISPR, you'll see all this sort of stuff, right? Now, it used to be a lab to do that sort of DNA processing was a couple of million dollars worth of equipment. I can buy a DNA cooker now that'll sit on my workbench for less than $50,000. So now if you take AI and you take this idea of synthetic DNA, so the AI will crunch all the protein and DNA to tell me the outcome that I want to produce. I then use the homemade DNA editing and protein sequencing to create that. You're actually at a point where you are going to start to create simulated life. You're going to create types of life that never existed before.
Dangerous stuff. Yeah, Albert's just finished reading Frankenstein, which seemed like a pretty good sort of tie into that when you're putting stuff together. And that, I don't know how far that is from, there's a difference, I guess, between creating something in a Petri dish and creating something that could pop out of your cooker and run around a cage or something.
So So growing sort of fresh creations from scratch is still a number of years off, but people are doing things like gene splicing and gene editing to create. Mm. You can go, I kid you not, go Google glow-in-the-dark dogs, because this is one of the most popular experiments that the CRISPR crowd do.
I've Googled weird things.
So for me, where does all this come together? So the idea of synthetic biology is you can create things from scratch, but there's also a school of synthetic biology that says, well, could we edit us? Could we edit what we do? Could we edit the way that we interact with the world? Could we edit the way that we take on information? And there's a lovely example. We've talked about some of the really scary stuff about AI. I want to give you a lovely example of where this idea of synthetic biology, real biology, and AI all meet together, right? So in 2019 in Germany, there was a patient who had ALS and was at the point of being locked in. So once you're locked in, effectively, you've got no body movement, you're being respirated, your brain is still functioning, but everything else has stopped. So 2019, his family gave permission for two electrodes to be implanted into his brain. By 2022, 43 electrodes had been implanted into the brain, and there was an AI tool monitoring the outcome, the outputs of those electrodes. And it started to spot patterns in those electrodes, and it started to spot thought patterns. And then it started to communicate back with the brain of this person with ALS. And they got to the point where now this person with ALS, the very first words he ever said on a computer screen, just using his thoughts, were, "I love my cool son."
Oh, wow.
But they would never have been able, if you imagine all those different sparks from his neurons flying off without AI, they would have never been able to pattern recognize those thoughts as thoughts.
The power of it is just, and it's the power of the software as opposed to the power of the underlying machine. That's the key.
Yeah.
Isn't it? And medicine in particular, and you mentioned vaccines before, but they're using it to, scan, like brain scans and scans for cancer and all that sort of stuff, because it has the huge amount of data to look for the patterns and to and to predict, I guess, if one for a better word, what something looks like today, what that could be like in 6 months' time, because it has the mass of data and knowledge and everything it can do. And it's just, it can do stuff that people are never going to be able to do, and normal computers are never going to be able to do in the sense of a traditional computer without AI.
And so for me, I guess where I go with this is, in AI, there's the scary point in AI is this thing called singularity. And the singularity is where we've managed to create AI that is of general intelligence, so it's capable of learning on its own about absolutely anything, not a specific model that it's given. Once it starts to learn about everything, if it's then connected into the world, do you get to the point where actually it says, well, I've looked around and humans are the biggest cause of problem on this planet. And the singularity is the point where we have got technology to the point where it takes over from us and we cannot any longer catch it up. For me, and I'm going to bring it in now, we're actually 51 minutes in, I'm going to bring the Matrix in, right?
Hey.
So for me, the idea of AGI, artificial general intelligence, is probably going to require a human brain. So we're going to have to take the ACI, the artificially capable intelligence, and there's a magic ingredient with synthetic biology that we could add to that, and that would be the human brain. So if you take artificially capable intelligence, but then you take the conscious understanding a human brain has and blend the two together using some sort of synthetic biology, at that point, I don't think anyone will know if they're living in a simulation or not. I think the world will be a remarkably different place to the world it is today. And if you want to get a feel for what that might be like, there's an American author called William Gibson who wrote a book called Neuromancer many, many years ago. And he talks about people jacking in. And the idea is that they literally connect in. And it's, so I want to learn how to fly a Chinook helicopter. I jack in and I get the information in my brain in an instant. And for me, that's where this, you know, whether that, I couldn't tell you if that's in 30 years' time, 50 years' time, or 100 years' time. But for me, that's where this goes. We start to enhance human, if you start to take the consciousness of a human and the moral model that humans have and the perceptions of the world that the humans have, and you supplement that, you augment it with artificially capable intelligence through some sort of synthetic biology link.
So do you think then, by saying that, do you think that without the human brain, that AI, even the general AI, would never be able to replicate the same decisions? It might not feel emotion, but it would understand the actions and consequences that come from emotion. So it could still respond as though it has emotions just by having enough data about how people respond to those emotions. Do you think that's not going to happen?
No, I think that sort of artificial capable intelligence is as far as we're going to go until we start to integrate real biology into it. I think you'll see very good mimics. ChatGPT is a very good mimic, and it's only going to get better, but it's never going to feel your pain.
No, but if enough people describe the pain, and when the AI is taking, you know, visual input, when it can see and understand what it's seeing, it's going to build up what a picture of pain is.
It is, but it'll never experience it or feel it. And that's the thing for me.
It might simulate it, feel it, will it though? It might be able to mirror what it looks like, but they won't have that sensation of it, will they? If that makes sense.
No, true, but does it need to achieve whatever it's, you know, to achieve the singularity? Does it need to actually feel?
My fear is if it doesn't, and if we don't choose to integrate into it, if it can't feel it, it just goes, I understand what pain is, and now I'm going to stop it.
Yeah, fair point.
So that's why I want this to integrate with it. I want it to feel these things.
My ultimate fear, and I suspect it's the ultimate fear of many, is you talked about morality and you talked about emotional understanding and what have you, and how it could potentially replicate it. The big fear is that when you actually stop and you look around, you do realize actually the Earth would be a pretty fantastic place if it wasn't for humans making a mess of it on a daily basis. There is a real fear that you create something so intelligent that recognizes what the problem is and then decides to execute that problem and improve the Earth in a way that perhaps needs.
And there you go. That's exactly it, Beans. That's why I want us to integrate with this as soon as we possibly can. Because I think it needs to take on our feelings for the world as much as its solution to the problems.
Because if it only responds to what it sees written or hears, and I think there's not many, there's probably an awful lot of people that would have the view that the planet would be better without humans. And if we're all there on podcasts like this saying, you know what, it would be better. And the AI is going, you know what? Yeah, everyone's saying it. So it must be right. All right, let's just get rid of more.
Yeah.
And I guess that it could almost be self-fulfilling, couldn't it? Because it's hard to argue, no, we're great for it. We don't cause problem. We don't tarmac over the natural landscape and throw bombs at it and pollute it. Yeah, we're great. You know, it's not true, is it? So... And then I suppose that the AI is going to start to get into, well, actually, you know, humans are humans, but they are just one entity. You know, you do have other animals, and a lot of animals are actually pretty intelligent. You know, they can't do some of the things, or a lot of the things humans can't do, but actually, as a benchmark against, you know, some sort of plankton, you know, whales are pretty smart. So the AI might just go, you know what? You know, it might one day just vote for the dolphins and, you know, so long and thanks for all the fish.
So in the simulation communities that I'm part of and discussions are happening, the way that AI has impacted a lot of the people in the discussions around simulation theory is the singularity the end of our simulation? So do we get to the point where we've achieved an intelligence greater than us that decides that we are a problem, and that does that therefore end our dominant part of the simulation? What comes next after us in the simulation?
What happens after the time of men? You know, to use a Lord of the Rings analogy.
Yeah.
After our time is up. Yeah, interesting.
And that's why the whole artificial intelligence thing has really got the simulation theory community going, because it's actually for the first time ever there's a potential that something's going to come along that will take the simulation to another level where humankind isn't involved.
Gee whiz. I don't know which I prefer. I think I prefer to be in a simulation if that were the alternative. I don't know. You know, I was dead against the idea the last time you were on. Now it's starting to sound like a really good idea.
I'd rather be in a simulation than not be here at all, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't know you weren't here, so
there you go. Yeah. And just to pick up on your thing about the ocular, the ability for it to see your pain, and obviously we are using cameras. Give you another example of the power of AI. There's a company based out of, I think it's Boston. Don't quote me on that, but it's somewhere, North American company, have figured out that using the reflection of Wi-Fi signals in a room, it can feed the way Wi-Fi signals are being reflected back, can feed that to an AI, it models, and it can tell you where everybody is standing in a room. It literally draws a model of the size and shape of everybody standing in a room just off the Wi-Fi transmitters that are in the room.
Okay, that's a bit scary, isn't it?
So you don't even need cameras to be monitored anymore. But imagine in law enforcement, in things like hostage situations.
Mm.
Yeah.
Where that would be massively beneficial.
Just basically give the AI a gun that can fire through walls and plug it into the Wi-Fi.
Well, AI is being used. So in the Ukraine, they're already using AI-based monitoring drones to monitor areas of terrain. And effectively, they've been trained on what a hostile looks like. And for the first time ever, they were given permission to fire without human control. Wow. This year.
Wow. This reminds me, we had a conversation before we had Steve, somebody like Steve, and knew what he was talking about, and the three of us were talking about
we don't know what
none of us know what we're talking about at any point.
And if you remember, guys, we were talking, my memory is so bad now, I'm thinking, was this the episode Steve was on or not? I don't know. But we were talking about AI, and I used an example of the stock market. And if you gave two AIs $100 each and let them loose on the stock market, which one would make the most money ultimately? And the idea being that they both make the best decisions possible and end up pretty much at the same place. Or I think we also talked about playing poker, that they could count the cards in the same way. They played the same odds, and then it would come down to luck. But if you had a situation, what Steve has just been talking about, war, and you've got drones that are using AI, both sides are using AI to fire missiles and shoot down missiles and dodge missiles, what's going to happen? I mean, once you reach a certain point in AI, is all things equal, or can one AI be better than another AI?
Well, what would happen is it'd go back to that, and this is a really geeky analogy, I suppose, it goes back to that Matthew Broderick War Games film where you've got a whopper or whatever, and it goes, actually it gets to the point where it realizes there's no win because no side can win, so therefore what's the point of playing in the game in the first place type thing. And I suppose you might get to a point where if you've got one AI and another AI and they go, well, actually I'm going to predict he's going to do this and I'm going to predict he's going to do this and so on and so on and so on and ad infinitum, that they'll turn around and go, well, actually what's the point in the first place?
So I'll give you my answer to your question there, actually, David. So all AI is not built equal. So in the same way that if I gave two accountants a spreadsheet, like Excel, and I asked them to build me a cash flow forecast, one might be a very manual cash flow forecast, the other one might have lots of macros built into it. So actually, ultimately, it comes down to the quality of the algorithms that you're building into the AI. And they are getting smaller and faster and better. So there's a, if you think about ChatGPT, and they're using what are called a large language model. I think the first time that they released ChatGPT, which was 2.0 to the world, the amount of code to build the algorithm was something like 60,000 lines of code. So, and that was because they had to do all sorts of guardrails around it, not being, you know, doing daft things in front of people. And so there was a lot of hard coding in the algorithm. If you now go to an organization called Nano LLM, which are, they share it all publicly, in 300 lines of code, they've created a GPT that will create works that are pretty much on a par with Shakespeare. So 300 lines of code to create the algorithm that then goes and reads enough information out there to then produce something that's on a par with Shakespeare. So that's down to, you know, if you're gonna feed the poetry that you're gonna get paid for, feed it to one of the really efficient algorithms, because it'll get it out there a lot. Have you guys ever looked at Bitcoin? Have you ever had one of your podcasts around Bitcoin and all that sort of stuff?
I feel there might be an episode in the future about that one, Stephen.
So no, the reason I'm asking is because Bitcoin is based on a technology called blockchain, and blockchain pretty much, if it's implemented right, is pretty much a way that you can find and secure the source of anything that has been created. If you stamp it with a blockchain stamp, it's pretty much got a serial number that no matter how much you break it up and spread it around the world, part of the DNA of whatever it is you create will stay within that blockchain. So you can backchain where everything ever came from. So in the model that Dave is talking about, where he writes his poetry, if he puts it into as some of these LLMs and they come and collect it off him, what would happen, and one of the ways you could actually earn more money using the AI model, is effectively there's a little bit of a fingerprint of David's work in all of the LLMs that reuse it in some way to create some new content. So actually, if you bring blockchain into this, if someone's really good at writing poetry and it gets used a lot by lots of algorithms out there, you could actually backchain and see how much it's been used and therefore give an outpayment like a royalty based on that. So that's another technology that we've got. And at the moment, we're trying to use it to flog each other, you know, non-existent coins. But it's actually a really clever technology that is pretty much about fingerprinting any piece of content and being able to, no matter how much it gets broken up and reused, being able to tell where the original source for it came from.
Right, my head's just hurt from that, so, but I've got a question. So if you've said that AI is developed through programming and lines of code and so on the assumption that humans write the initial code that creates the initial AI, mm-hmm. and then you extrapolate that into the future and you go, so therefore can an AI create an AI? And so can an AI learn to create a different AI, just like humans have learned to create AI because of the coding that's gone into it in the first place? Can an AI learn to code a different AI?
Where we're at today, an AI can be used to improve an existing AI. As of today's day, I'm not aware of any AIs that have gone, you know, to make my task doable, I now need to create a different type of AI. Right. And I think when we get to that, that's when we're at the point where we're creating artificial general intelligence.
Yeah.
Not artificially capable intelligence.
Yeah. Because what you're saying is you're saying that humans are needed to write the initial code to create the AI that then can then do various things even better than the human. But you need a human in the first place to do that. So I suppose the point is then, do you then need an AI to create an AI to create an AI that does whatever?
Or you say we live in a simulation where we've got synthetic biological computers which have got AI capable of creating new thought pathways in their synapses, which also, if they want to create more equivalent biological entities, they've got this process of reproducing them, manufacturing them. Yeah. And then you say, well, that looks remarkably like us, so aren't we just in a simulation?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Right. I think it's time now. My head is... pain capacity and nothing to do with the bronchitis. There was a little bit of me that was semi-fond of AI there, where it sounded a bit like Data out of Star Trek, trying to understand us, trying to get on board with our emotions. And then we went full on Terminator 2, and we were wiping each other out using AI from both sides. So it's an interesting subject. It's an interesting topic. And it's one that still... every little bit I learn about it still terrifies me. And now we're talking about synthetic biology and what it can potentially create. At first, I went down a route of, could we give AI to dogs and create Paw Patrol? And then again, it went darker again, you know what I mean? And the idea of it creating something that's not existed before, that manufacturing something that potentially could control. Well, I don't think I'm going to sleep very well tonight, Stephen, so I'll thank you in advance for that. But if I honestly, I've loved this episode. It's been fascinating. It really has been fascinating. And again, like I say, I'm glad I made no notes, because the last time I went into it with preconceptions which were all wrong, and this time, you know, just to hear about it and learn about it, and I do feel like I've learned something. And hopefully people who have jacked on at home, no jacking off, you naughty boys, you know, jacked on at home, and I've hopefully learned something, can download that into their system. It has been a very, very interesting episode. So, Steve, no doubt we'll be doing another episode with you at some point in the future. But for now, if you'd like to say thank you or goodbye to our listeners, I should say.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on. I think what we said was how anyone can ever live with me is quite a phenomenal feat in its own right. So I think one of the things we're talking about is whether or not you have Lindsay and I on together and she can tell you what it's like.
Yes. Yes. Well, this is the thing. So for those folks who don't know, Lindsay, who's come on, she talked about the Pendle Witches. She talked about the last bit of Scotland. You know, that for me is the stuff that's about, you know, that's how my brain works. Stuff like that absolutely fascinate me. Stuff like this, truthfully, I still think is maybe a little bit beyond me. So those two things to me seem totally diametrically opposed. And I would love to get them in the same room together. And at some point this year, we've already said we're going to do that. You know, we probably going to run it past Lindsay first. I don't know, but she knows now. But no, definitely we will be doing that at some point this year.
But thank you very much for having me on. And thank you for thank you for listening to my crazy theories about where AI and simulation theory crossover.
No, thank you. Thank you is probably what we need to say, because it gives our listeners, hopefully what it gives us, it gives us the same thing. It gives us a different outlook on life. It gives us something else to think about than other our dreary mundane existences. Dave, have you enjoyed this one?
I have, yeah, because I'm quite fascinated by it. And it's not just your theories, Steve. A lot of it is actual information about what is happening. So it's quite educational as well. And unlike Adam, I don't see this as some kind of terrifying Terminator doomsday. I'm just looking forward to my cottage in the country writing poetry. I think it sounds great.
There you go. Gaz, are you going to be cottaging in the country?
No, I don't think so. I think I'm a bit between. I don't quite think I'm ready for the let's just all pack up and go to the country and like write poetry and some nice green fields. But similarly, I'm not quite the, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger's going to walk down the road with a gun in his hand and kick shit out of us all sort of thing. So I'm a bit like betwixt between. But look, I love the episodes of Steve on. He's incredibly educational. He challenges us in how we think and what we think about. And I think, as Dave said, it's brilliant in just as much as he sort of backs it up with relevant research and up-to-date research, and that's it's not just Steve saying it, he's actually got stuff to back it up with, if that makes sense. So incredibly fascinating. My head hurts, and I think about it, like the last time we were on, Steve, I thought about it and I'm like, yeah, my head still hurts. So I thank you again, just echo what Adam said, it's amazing when you come on, it's brilliant. I don't think we're quite ready and we quite all understand exactly what you're talking about, but we might take snippets. We might understand a tiny little bit. And the next time we come on, we might understand a tiny little bit more. And you know what? That's what it's all about. And if we can learn, then AI can learn. And who knows where that might take us. So fuck knows what will be in 10 years.
I guess that's it. We don't know. We're going to have to find out. However, you've given us a distinct insight into the world. And like you say, it's like the guy said, it's the knowledge as well that you back it up with. It's not just a theory. It's the information. It's the stuff that's out there that perhaps we aren't aware of. So yeah. I would like just to wrap it up and say thank you very much for joining us. Yeah. We look forward to the next time that you're on, and that should be a very interesting episode in itself. But for now, I will wish you all a good night and a fond farewell. And I hope that you will sleep easier than I do tonight. So take care.